that you are about to cross the border.
And then follow the footsteps to a two-hour-long sustained environment of uninterrupted sonic art or new electronic, experimental, or postmodern music. Audio that breaks and rewrites the rules to create entirely new worlds of sound. Where will you be on Mondays at 8 when the door slams shut? Here on KBOO Portland.
Looks like these kids are going to have some fun, doesn't it?
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of PDX Cocoon and their first public storytelling event on Thursday, March 12th at 5 p.m. at Lola's Room in Portland. The theme of this first storytelling event is risk. PDX Cocoon is a student-led group that is working to facilitate storytelling for Portland youth through workshops and events. Again, that's Episode 1, Risk, by PDX Cocoon on Thursday, March 12th, 5 p.m. at Lola's Room, below the Crystal Ballroom at 1332 West Burnside in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
I'd sure hate to be left out.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Every Monday night at 8 o'clock, you can hear this voice alerting you that
you are about to cross the border.
And then follow the footsteps to a two-hour-long sustained environment of uninterrupted sonic art or new electronic, experimental, or postmodern music. Audio that breaks and rewrites the rules to create entirely new worlds of sound. Where will you be on Mondays at 8 when the door slams shut?
Yeah.
The time is 5:01 p.m. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next on KBOO, it's the evening news.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portlanders rally to oppose the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal.
Rhode Island becomes the latest state to push for labeling of genetically modified organisms.
The Obama administration places sanctions on Venezuelan government officials, calling them a threat to national security. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, March 9th, 2015. I'm Mario Haro.
And I'm Joanna Peterson. This weekend marked the 50th anniversary of the so-called Bloody Sunday in Selma, Alabama. The occasion was marked by a speech in Selma by President Obama. Political prisoner and commentator Mumia Abu-Jamal issued the commentary in response.
Unsaid at Selma, who can question whether President Barack Obama is a master when it comes to speeches. Such a quality literally put him on the map when he mesmerized a crowd at the 2004 Democratic National Convention. He did it again in Selma, Alabama's 50th anniversary at the Edmund Pettus Bridge. His central message, no one can doubt that things are better since Selma. No one. His speech, delivered with quiet passion, was a masterwork. And yet, Selma has become sacred in civil rights history, not because of what happened there, but because of what happened thereafter. Public outrage fueled the passage of the Voter Rights Act, the same law recently trimmed by the U.S. Supreme Court. Selma is a vivid example of an evil that still lives with us, that of police immunity for their violence. Selma, Alabama state troopers and so-called posse men. Beat people unconscious. They shattered skulls, broke ribs, knocked out teeth, and broke bones. Guess how many of them went to jail? None. Just 4 years after Selma, Chicago cops broke into the apartment of Black Panther leader Fred Hampton and killed him in his sleep. They also killed Captain Mark Clark. Guess how many cops went to jail? Zero. Zip to our present and the Mike Brown case. No criminal trial, state or federal. Too hard, say federal prosecutors. On May 13, 1985, cops drop bombs from a helicopter and shoot and burn 11 men, women, and children to death, and also destroy several city blocks. In that case, 20 years after Selma, how many cops went to jail? You know, none. Obama could have addressed police immunity, but that would have shattered his "we're all better" speech. What radicalized and motivated Ferguson was a long train of police impunity and immunity after violence against the community. They had seen it too many times. So Selma is closer than we think. It continues to trouble us today. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Tens of thousands of people converged on the city of Selma, Alabama, over the weekend to commemorate the 50th anniversary of a march for voting rights that was a milestone of the civil rights movement. The March 7, 1965 voting rights demonstration made international headlines after Alabama state troopers attacked civil rights activists at a bridge in Selma, which still bears the name of a Confederate general and ranking member of the KKK. Also this weekend, friends and family of Tony Robinson mourn the death of the 19-year-old who was shot dead by a police officer in Madison, Wisconsin. High school students staged walkouts today and marched to the Wisconsin state capitol, building in protest. Robinson is the latest unarmed black teen killed by a white police officer since the shooting death of an 18-year-old Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, sparked a nationwide movement under the banner Black Lives Matter. Activists for police accountability continue to diligently organize, including in quieter settings like conferences and workshops. FSRN's Lena Nozitswe reports on one such gathering over the weekend at UCLA, which brought together academics, activists, and artists from around the country to focus on the history of the systemic racism and examine new ways to fight it.
The conference at UCLA, entitled Possessive Investments, Systems of Power, Possibilities of Dissent, brought together speakers from around the country to talk about past systematic racism. But as timing would have it, they had plenty to discuss about present-day institutional bias. Just days ahead of the forum, the Department of Justice released a scathing 105-page report on racism within the police department and municipal court system in Ferguson, Missouri. The findings of the report were no surprise to UCLA graduate student and local Black Lives Matter organizer Shamel Bell.
So for a lot of us, and a lot of us people that have been organizing, it's exactly what we already knew. So, but sometimes people need statistics and sometimes people need data. And so I think that's what also points to the role of academics and the role of conferences and the role of, you know, people bringing that information. It's about educating people.
Long before Michael Brown's death, the black residents of Ferguson had been complaining that biased policing was engineered to generate revenue rather than to protect and serve. According to the DOJ report, fees and fines make up the second largest source of municipal revenue for the city. The average household in Ferguson, a city whose population is 67% black, was billed more than $300 last year based on what has amounted to policing for profit. Distin Jenkins, a PhD candidate in history at Stanford University, says the push to ticket, combined with racially biased law enforcement, constitutes a de facto form of targeted taxation.
For us to sort of think about reforming police departments and the municipal state in general, we have to engage with questions of taxation, municipal finance. As boring as it is the key battleground.
Reforming municipal finances was one of many strategies presented as ways to keep the movement alive beyond traditional street protests. Shamel Bell says expressions of dissent can take on multiple forms.
We need a united front. We need a solidarity. And in order to do that, I'm going to as many events as I can, put it on as many events as I can, so that we can continue to have these radical dialogues, because we inside of us already have the answers to liberation.
The World Arts and Culture dance graduate student was one of a group of activist artists to demonstrate her moves.
Right, I mean left.
At the closing session of the event, organizers from Black Lives Matter prompted conference goers to honor black men and women recently killed by violence, including police killings.
Oscar Grant.
Chavis Atuman Robinet, a.k.a. African.
Anniversaries of important moments in the civil rights movement have also served to highlight the importance of connecting historical struggles to their present-day context. Military veteran and former Black Panther member Hank Jones says an event that inspired his own activism was the 1955 lynching of Emmett Till. 14-year-old Till was tortured and murdered for allegedly flirting with a white woman.
His mother was wise enough to have an open casket to show what how they had brutally tortured and disfigured her son, you know, and he was just 14. And so that outraged not just the country, but the world.
Two white men admitted to murdering Till only after a jury voted to acquit them after only 67 minutes of deliberation. The acquittal shielded the pair from facing the same charges a second time. Jones will turn 80 this year, and he says he's lived long enough to see history repeat itself. He does, however, sound wistful when contemplating the real-time organizing potential of modern-day tools like social media.
I think, you know, if we had the kind of ability to communicate like they do today, instantaneous transference of information, there's no telling what we could have accomplished, you know.
Even with the speed of present-day communications, Black Lives Matter activists are mindful of the context of the past struggles to give power to future organizing. Jones hopes that today's protesters will take the time to study the history of his generation of activists and learn from the mistakes and successes. The organizers pushing the movement forward are looking past tweeted hashtags to seek out activists who are in it for the long haul, on and offline. Lennon Ozizwe, FSRN, Los Angeles.
Members of a University of Oklahoma fraternity were forced to vacate their house and close their local chapter today after appearing in an online video chanting racist remarks. School President David Boren said that the university has cut ties with Sigma Alpha Epsilon fraternity and could expel members who appeared in the video. Warren joined students at an early morning rally shortly after an investigation confirmed the contents of the online video. The video shows several fraternity members chanting about how blacks would never be admitted to the fraternity. The chant includes a racial slur and a reference to lynching. The national fraternity released an apologetic statement Sunday night, and it said it would close the local chapter. Warren ordered members to vacate the fraternity house within a day. A black student group on campus, OU Unheard, posted a link to the video yesterday afternoon after an anonymous source called it to the group's attention. The University of Oklahoma has about 27,000 students, and about 5% are black. The Greek system is mostly segregated. This incident follows the expulsion of a Washington State University student and fraternity member last month, after he directed racial slurs at black women on Greek Row.
Oregon lawmakers are looking at a bill that might cut fifth-year programs designed to help transition high school students into college. Oregon allows certain students to take additional courses at a community college during a fifth year of high school instead of getting a high school diploma at the end of 4 years. The students are still part of the high school district, which means that the district receives state funding that helps cover the students' college expenses. Supporters of the fifth-year program say that this system prepares students for college, but but Senate Bill 322 sponsors argue that there is an ethical problem with pouring money meant for K-12 into higher education. A hearing on the bill is set for March 9th in Salem.
TriMet and Google are partnering to give riders real-time data on max arrival times. Today, the information became available on Android smartphones. Google installed a series of Bluetooth transmitters at Portland's train stations last week, enabling updates to be sent to nearby commuters. These beacons automatically connect with smartphones and create pop-up notifications on home screens. Users can tap the notifications to read detailed arrival information about the next max. TriMet is the first U.S. transit agency to use the technology, and it did not pay for Google services. The system won't work on devices using Apple's iOS. The notifications will only be available on Android phones that use newer 5.0 and Lollipop systems.
A new report has revealed that the state of Florida ordered employees to not use the terms climate change and global warming. The two terms are among several that the Florida Department of Environmental Protection ordered employees not to use. The policy went into effect when Governor Rick Scott nominated Herschel Vineyard to head the Florida Department of the Environmental Protection, known as the Florida DEP. Both the Florida DEP and the governor's office denied the report, but several employees from multiple offices around the state confirmed that the gag order was well known to department employees. The employees said they were told that using the terms would endanger the funding for their individual projects. In addition to the prohibited terms of climate change and global warming, were sea level rise and sustainability. At the time the order was implemented, Herschel Vineyard was the head of the Florida DEP. Vineyard previously had served as director of operations for BAE Systems, Southeast Shipyards, in Jacksonville, Florida. BAE Systems is one of the world's largest defense contractors and shipbuilders. While working at BAE Systems, Herschel Vineyard lobbied the Florida government and the Florida DEP for decreased environmental regulations for the BAE shipyards.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for a discussion with Portland's Mayor Charlie Hales, followed by Labor Radio at 6. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline, and at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is sunny again and unseasonably warm, with some clouds and a high of 68. Today in history, on March 19th, 1933, President Franklin Roosevelt submits the Emergency Banking Act to Congress to ease the run on small banks, causing them to go into bankruptcy. The quote of the day is from the late civil rights activist Medgar Evers, who said, "In the racial picture, things will never be as they once were. History has reached a turning point, here and over the world."
It's 5:17, time for the daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Look out! The Supreme Court's Black Robe Gang of far-right ideologues are rampaging again. The Supreme Klan is firing potshots at Obamacare, and their political recklessness endangers justice, the court's own integrity, and the health of millions of innocent bystanders. In an effort to override the law, these so-called justices have jumped on a wagon load of legalistic BS named King versus Burwell. But this case is a very rickety legal vehicle. It sprang from a frivolous lawsuit concocted in 2010 by a front group funded by such self-serving oligarchs as the Koch brothers, Big Oil, Big Tobacco, and Big Pharma. The chairman of the front group bluntly and rather crudely described the purpose of the lawsuit as a raw political assault on Obamacare. Quote, "This bastard has to be killed as a matter of political hygiene," he howled. "I do not care how this is done, whether it's dismembered, whether we drive a stake through its heart, whether we strangle it." So much for the intellectual depth of the King case, which was fabricated on a nitpicking interpretation of only four words in the 906-page healthcare law. The claim is that the subsidy provided by Obamacare to make its coverage affordable to all is an illegal backdoor bribe to force every state to allow their people access to a federal benefit they otherwise couldn't afford. That's right-wing tommyrot, which was rejected by both the district and appeals courts, and even corporate interests have dubbed the claim absurd. Nonetheless, the gang of Supremes grabbed the case as a chance to wreak their own brand of ideological havoc on a law they personally dislike. This is Jim Hightower saying, by taking over this case, these Republican judges have openly become partisans, thrusting the Supreme Court itself into the forefront of the GOP's war against Obamacare and against Obama himself. Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. The United Steelworkers met with Royal Dutch Shell in Houston Monday in an effort to come to an agreement that would end the USW oil refinery strike that began January 21st. It's the first major oil refinery strike in 35 years. USW Vice President Tom Conway says the 6,000 workers on strike at 15 plants, including a dozen refineries, want to make sure that they get a contract that addresses their biggest concern. Safety.
While, you know, money and wages are important issues, that's not what this strike is about. This strike is about safe staffing levels inside the refineries and staffing levels of our maintenance workforces and having safe and reliable and efficient staffing in the refineries.
Hundreds of protesters packed Madison's Capitol Rotunda Monday protesting the weekend police killing of 19-year-old Tony Robinson. Robinson was shot to death after Madison police say he attacked the responding officer. Robinson was unarmed but had recently been convicted of armed robbery and a home invasion. Police were called because Robinson was allegedly jumping into traffic and had allegedly assaulted a person, including trying to strangle someone. When the police arrived, Robinson ran into an apartment where Officer Matt Kenny followed. Kenny said he heard a commotion inside, forced entry, and was knocked down by a blow to the head from Robinson during a scuffle. Kenny then shot Robinson to death. Kenny shot and killed another man while on duty in 2007 and was cleared of any wrongdoing in that death. Madison Police Chief Mike Koval has apologized for the tragic death and prayed with the family of Robinson after the killing. Racial disparities in arrests by police and in the public schools in Madison has been well documented. An investigation into the police shooting of Robinson is underway by a state agency. Madison Mayor Paul Soglin says this death is a tragedy.
It's a tragedy that's beyond description. This is a kid. There's a hole in his family that will never be filled. There's nothing any of us can say that is going to make it right. I've dreaded knowing that this was a possibility. It's a possibility in any city.
More than 100 drivers in three California communities have joined the Teamsters Union. The drivers work for Ryder Integrated Logistics. The Teamsters already represent 350 Ryder mechanics in California and in Las Vegas.
Workers Independent News is proud to be heard on The Union Edge, Labor's Talk Radio. Live nationwide weekdays noon to 3 p.m. at theunionedge.com. Workers Independent News is brought to you by the American Federation of Teachers and its 1.6 million members working to reclaim the promise of public education, health care, and public services for our students, their families, and our communities. More information online at aft.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
GMO labeling is getting another shot in Rhode Island. State Senator Donna Nesselbush just introduced two bills that would mandate the labeling of any genetically engineered food ingredients. These bills would also prevent GMO products from being considered natural foods. This latest push for GMO labeling comes after similar bills failed to pass in Rhode Island legislature in both 2013 and 2014. Large agribusiness conglomerates like Monsanto have funded major fights against the Right to Know movement in the U.S. These biotechnology giants have spent more than $100 million in the fight against GM food labeling across the nation.
Yesterday, a group of Greek anarchists occupied the headquarters of the governing party in Syriza in Athens in solidarity with an ongoing hunger strike in the Greek prisons. They hung large banners off the party headquarters balconies. This past week, a number of anarchists and other political prisoners have been on hunger strike against the high-security Type C prisons. This is also in response to the arrest of people suspected of involvement with or support of the conspiracy of Cells of Fire group, including the arrest of suspects' family members. Demands included abolition of two anti-terrorism laws targeting organizations as well as the legal framework for Type C prisons, and the immediate release of Savas Zeros on health grounds. Zeros was convicted for participation in the revolutionary organization 17 November, a radical leftist group established in 1975. RO-17 seeks the ousting of U.S. bases from Greece, the removal of Turkish military forces from Cyprus, and the severing of Greece's ties to NATO and the European Union. The group initially conducted assassinations of senior U.S. officials and Greek public figures, and adding bombings in the 1980s. Since 1998, it has expanded its targets to include EU facilities and foreign firms, investing in Greece, and has added improvised rocket attacks to its methods. It supports itself largely through bank robberies. A number of Greek prisoners began a hunger strike last week aiming at the abolition of the high-security prisons introduced by the previous government, which house prisoners see as particularly dangerous in severe conditions, including isolation. The pretext for the creation of the Type C prisons was the escape of November 17th member Christopher Zeros back in January 14th. Zeros was recaptured this year. Since his recapture, the police have arrested a number of people they claim were working with him, including family members of the detained. A press release in support of the hunger strike says these ongoing events will test whether the recently elected leftist coalition party Syriza is willing or able to dismantle the authoritarian structures put in place by previous governments.
The president of the European Union, Jean-Claude Juncker, has called for the creation of an EU army. The EU president stated that the European Union needed a military force separate from NATO in order to respond credibly to threats to EU countries and their neighbors. The European Union already shares a parliament and common currency. The creation of a common military force would further integrate the member countries under the European Union. The president of the EU said, "Currently, foreign policy is determined independently by member countries, creating disjointed responses to regional security concerns." Britain responded that they would not approve of a common army under the control of the European Union. Britain is a member of the European Union, but does not share the euro as its monetary currency. Leading German politicians approved of the proposal, including the German defense minister, who approved of the plan if it meant the termination of member countries' militaries to one controlled exclusively by the European Parliament and Commission. Russia called the proposal provocative, stating that a new army in a nuclear-armed age adds no additional security, but increases further militarization of the region. Currently, Europe is protected militarily by NATO, a military organization led by the United States. The U.S. ambassador to the United Nations responded to the EU army proposal, saying the European Union would show itself to be more serious about its protection by increasing military spending to NATO, not by creating a separate army. Many analysts believe the proposal would decrease European security by adding a separate, possibly contrary view to the current policies from NATO.
President Obama today issued an executive order that places economic sanctions on 7 Venezuelan officials. He accused the officials of creating a threat to U.S. national security. The sanctions target 7 specific Venezuelan government officials who the U.S. claims have been involved in violent actions against the opposition. KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with Venezuelan sociologist Maria Paez Victor, who says the accusations by the Obama administration are ridiculous.
I wonder if I could just get your initial reaction to President Obama's executive order today regarding Venezuela.
The first thing I just want to tell you and your listeners is that Venezuela is a neighbor and a friendly nation. Venezuelans have no hatred towards the United States, towards Americans at all. But all of a sudden, they're labeled as a risk to the United States. I ask you, what is Obama drinking? The hubris, the arrogance, the hypocrisy of this executive order is astounding. Venezuela, a security risk? Seriously, the United States, the size of the armed forces is about 1,300,000 soldiers. It spends $500 billion annually. That's 39% of the world military expenditure. The truth is that the United States could annihilate Venezuela in a matter of days if it brought down its military might on it. And I hope to God it never happens. The executive order goes on to say that it's concerned over Venezuelan human rights. Well, where were they when in 1989 the previous government gunned down 3,000 people on the streets of Caracas because they protested the austerity measures imposed by the IMF and the United States? Nowhere. Not the United States, not any other powerful country or organization was concerned about the human rights of Venezuelans then. So is the United States, who is so concerned about human rights, where is the concern over Saudi Arabia, where they are beheading people every month, where women are stoned and not allowed even to drive? Is it concerned with that? Is it concerned with Kuwait and Bahrain and the Emirates?
It's interesting, the notes on the different members of the Venezuelan government that were listed in this executive order, referring to the nation's chief prosecutor prosecuting several people for attempted coups, and then the chief of police for, it says, engaging in abuses during protests in February 2014, this time last year. And you had written actually at that time about the protests and that they were orchestrated by the United States that was trying to overthrow the government there in Venezuela.
Yes. You know, let's keep it at the level of what you can actually see. In the United States, and I'm talking to you here from Canada, it is inconceivable and it would never be accepted by any authority, be it local, provincial, or federal, that any leader would go out, face a mob, and tell them, go out and burn and kill. And this is what these people did. And so the ones who have been imprisoned, they are there for their crimes. It isn't for what they think, because they're opposition, but because they were the cause of 43 people, innocent people, losing their lives, and 870 people terribly injured. Now, this is criminal. This would not be accepted in the United States. This would not be accepted in Canada. Then Venezuela has the proofs, is going through a proper judicial process. So when these protests were occurring, where were the United States and the organization? Why weren't they saying that it's the opposition who is trashing the human rights of Venezuelans, who couldn't get past these barricades, who couldn't get to the doctor? There were several people who actually died because they couldn't pass these barricades. They chopped down 5,000 trees. They poisoned the water reservoir for a big city called Merida. They did all these terrible vandalism in order to, what did they want? They wanted a government who won the elections with the same proportion that Obama won his election.
What do you think is the significance of the fact that Venezuela has the largest known oil reserves?
Well, as I said, if we only had potatoes, nobody would care what Venezuela had. But it's more than just the oil, because what is Venezuela going to do with that petroleum? Is it going to eat it? No. What it has to do is sell it. And it has not said that it's not going to sell petroleum. It will sell petroleum to anybody, because that is, you know, really a mainstay for the country. So it's not a question of access to the petroleum, because the United States has all the access to the petroleum that they want if they want to buy it. It's because they want to control it. Because before, the petroleum was the toy thing of a very corrupt, a very racist elite of Venezuelans who ruled that country for 40 years and were the great partners of international organizations and the United States. And so what they want to do is simply get hold of that petroleum, of the petroleum money, because what President Chavez declared almost as soon as he became president was the petroleum belongs to the people. It doesn't belong to this elite. And so it started channeling the money of the petroleum not to luxurious buildings and things that what they were using before, but for free health care, for free education. They have built about 200,000 new homes in the last 2 years. All that money has been channeled into the benefit of the people, because remember, this has always been an oil-rich country. How could it be that in 1999, 80% of its people were poor? That's outrageous. And now Venezuela is the country that has the least economic inequality in the region, according to the Gini coefficient. This is an enormous change in the country. And so this is what is happening. The elites want to control the government, want to control the petroleum, want to use it for their own purposes, and they don't believe in the social advance. They want people to be poor and stupid. And now they've got a population that not only can read and write, but is actually educated. It has the largest number of proportion of people studying in the university in the region. And their eyes have been opened. They're not going to take this anymore.
I've been speaking with Maria Paez Victor. She is a Venezuelan sociologist. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
A rally is going on right now to call on Oregon's representatives in the U.S. Congress to stop the fast track of a trans-Pacific trade agreement that they say will cost U.S. jobs and hurt the environment. Senator Ron Wyden is the main target of the protests, since he plays a key role in Congress on the issue. Despite losing his chairmanship of the Senate Finance Committee after Republicans won control of the chamber last year, he finds himself in a powerful position because of the unusual politics of international trade. Big trade agreements need bipartisan support to pass Congress, and Wyden is the one Democrat in the position to work with Republicans to pass the deal. What is at stake is the Trans-Pacific Partnership, a trade deal under negotiation involving the U.S. and 11 other Pacific Rim nations. It would be the largest free trade pact ever for the U.S. and has generated intense controversy. It has been criticized for the secrecy of the negotiations and the text of the deal, and the fact that hundreds of corporate representatives have helped to draft it without any public input. For more, we go to KBOO's Ethan Martin, who is live at the scene of the protest. Ethan, what's the scene out there at Director Park right now?
Well, it's pretty bustling. There's probably about 250 to 300 people gathered here at Director Park. Right now, they're kind of just beginning to get things underway. They were just having a group of workers in construction attire. The Carpenters Union leading some chants opposing the TPP and the Fast Track. They're about to get some speeches from various people underway. And, yeah, overall, it's a very optimistic and motivated atmosphere down here.
Okay, is there any police presence that you see?
I have seen no police presence whatsoever. Seems very organized overall, and I'm sure they have... Yeah, there's no police as far as I can tell.
Are there any protesters we can talk to?
Yeah, for sure. I have a fellow on hand named Ian with Working Families, and here he is.
Hi, this is Ian.
How's it going, Ian? What's the main reason you are opposed to the TPP?
I'm opposed to the TPP because it could lead to the loss of American jobs, and the jobs gained overseas would be in inhuman working conditions for terrible low wages.
Okay. Can you talk about the importance of Ron Wyden in this issue?
So, Senator Wyden is the ranking Democrat on the committee which will vote whether or not to fast-track the TPP. And so many other people will be taking their cues from him, and that makes it a little bit up to Oregon and up to Wyden's constituents to put some pressure on him.
How does the TPP compare to NAFTA?
The TPP is often phrased as NAFTA on steroids, as it opens up trade to several more nations than NAFTA did, and does so with nations which have an even greater wage disparity, such as Vietnam, where the average wage is 75 cents an hour.
What are you hoping to accomplish at today's rally?
We are hoping to accomplish a demonstration of public opinion that Senator Wyden must vote no to fast-track the TPP, giving us the hope that we can stop the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
What are the next steps that people can take?
People can write Senator Wyden asking him to vote no on fast-tracking the TPP, as well as get involved with several petitions, or contract the Working Families Party or any union group to see what other organizing and volunteer work can be done.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Ian of the Working Family Parties and also with Ethan Martin, live from a rally against the Fast Track and the Trans-Pacific Partnership, taking place right now in Director's Park in downtown
Hello?
Portland.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org for Monday, March 9th, 2015. Soldiers invade West Bank communities and attack a school with tear gas, and in Gaza, Navy ships open fire on fishermen. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Scores of residents, including children, suffered on Monday morning the effects of tear gas inhalation as Israeli soldiers conducted military training near local schools in Hebron City in the southern part of the occupied West Bank. Eyewitnesses said that dozens of soldiers stormed the area while firing gas bombs and concussion grenades at random, causing scores to suffer the effects of tear gas inhalation. Local medics rushed to the scene and provided the wounded with the needed medical treatment. In addition, dozens of soldiers and settlers were deployed in various areas in Hebron, including the Islamic graveyard area and the Old City part, and conducted training using gas bombs and concussion grenades. On Monday at dawn, Israeli soldiers kidnapped 8 Palestinians in different parts of the occupied West Bank after storming their homes and violently searching them. Elsewhere, Israeli military bulldozers uprooted large areas of Palestinian farmlands east of the northern West Bank city of Nablus and uprooted more than 300 olive trees. Ghassan Douglas, a Palestinian official in charge of the Israeli settlement file in the northern part of the occupied West Bank, said that the soldiers uprooted and cut more than 300 olive trees and bulldozed large areas planted with wheat and barley. In other news, several Israeli military vehicles and bulldozers invaded Al-Jurashiyah village near the northern West Bank city of Tul Karim and demolished a home belonging to a local judge. The soldiers surrounded the home of Justice Kifah Shuli, a judge in the appeal court in the central West Bank city of Ramallah, demolished his property and the walls that surrounding it. The judge said he was still building his home and stopped the construction 2 years ago after the army ordered him to do so, under the pretext it was being built without a permit. In Gaza, Israeli Navy attacked Palestinian fishing boats off the shore of Beit Lahia in the northern part of the Gaza Strip. Damage was reported, but no injuries. Last week, Israeli attacks targeting fishing boats in Gaza left one fisherman dead. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Monday, March 9th, 2015 news roundup from occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Ishmawi and me, Ghassan Banoura.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Don Zur, Paul Rowland, and Joanna Peterson. Our engineer is Danielle Parks. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from the newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen for something to write with, The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Oregon Governor Kate Brown's number is 503-378-3111. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Mario Haro.
And I'm Joanna Peterson. Here's what's coming up on KBOO tomorrow morning. At 8 a.m., it's the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show, call-in talk radio. At 9, it's alternative radio. The show features investigative journalist Reese Ehrlich speaking on Cuba and the U.S., A New Beginning. At 10,